The more you use, the more you pay per unit. Well, I know you're going to say, well, what's the difference? The customer always pays for it in the end. And I know my end is getting pretty tender, as is that of a lot of other people. And you're thinking also, now I can hear the response, click, and here it comes. The more we deliver to each customer, the cheaper it is to give it to him on a per unit basis. Volume buying and all of that business. Bunk. The great weakness in that theory is now, as it has been from the start, is your industry has never truly charged off the cost of depletion resource to anyone, bulk user or anyone else. I suppose because you didn't put it there, you figure you don't have to pay to take it out. Well, you do, or we do, and the guy who takes most of it out, whether it's wasteful or ignorant, is the guy who ought to pay the most for it. We cannot continue to externalize the cost of depletion resource as we have done in the past couple of decades. And I think that until your industry comes to grips with that central situation and employs a more realistic pricing policy, I don't think you're going to be able to convince anyone, environmentalist or otherwise, about being genuinely concerned about conservation or problem solving. Now that's one thing you can do. In our time frame and our format this evening, since we're limited in time, and since I've already been trying to urge the industry and people in my profession to do just that, then perhaps a more pertinent point might be now to say, what else can I or other writers or broadcasters do to help build a stronger bridge over this gap? And as somebody earlier described it, it's more of a chasm than a gap today. Build a stronger bridge to the public, and that includes the decision makers as well as the ratepayers slash voters. Well, I think we must do a better job, obviously, of informing the public about this wild variety of complexities and dangers and hazards that we all face, and frustrations. But that means that people in my profession have to first get educated well enough so that they understand the basic issues. And I hope that you'll have some compassion and some sympathy for us in that regard. As I look out there, I see most of you have put a good number of years into the profession already to become the experts that you are, according to the earlier speaker. So nobody is going to come along from my business and learn in 4 or 5 months the kind of things he ought to learn to have the feel for this story, to get it across to a public who's already angry and frustrated anyway. And just because there are, I don't think there's any need for people in your profession to feel that there's naturally a credibility gap. I guess maybe I'm different than some of the other speakers tonight. I perceive a lot of anger and a lot of opposition to some of the things that are proposed by the industry, but I don't necessarily equate that with credibility lack. I think the oil industry obviously has a credibility problem, but I don't perceive the same problem anywhere near the same degree range in your industry. So don't perceive opposition and anger for credibility gap problems, because most of us are pretty frustrated today, and the fact that we want to kick somebody in the tail because of it can hardly be anything new to the American psyche. We've been a pretty angry people since history began for us. And when we don't get what we want, we strike out often. To do that, I guess, whether it means going back to school, as some people, some newspapers and some of the broadcast media are sending more and more of their people back to schools for prolonged seminars, sometimes for a whole year of course of study to get specialized in. And there are a lot of old-timers in our profession, as I'm sure there are in yours, that just really scoff at that and think it's a waste of time, the whole idea of specialization. But it's sort of a curious process, because it seems like the only time I bump into your public information officers are at functions like this. So I guess we've all got a lot to learn. I'd like to close with one last suggestion, and this applies equally to the president of Exxon or Texaco as it would SoCal Edison or PG&E. I think what all of us have got to do is we've got to stop thinking in terms of they and them and us. We've got to, or they and them, and start thinking more in terms of us. There is no they or them when it comes to the environment. We are all card-carrying environmentalists. Whether you like the word or not is immaterial. We all want to be able to breathe air that doesn't hurt our throats or blacken our lungs, And I think most of us want to be able to drink water without getting stricken with Montezuma's revenge. And I think most of us like the ocean, the mountains, and the forest, and the rivers. We enjoy these things. And we like to spend our time enjoying them. But I'd like to close, inasmuch as we are truly all in this together, with what I consider to be a rather eloquent, if somewhat time-worn, quotation that to me sums up the real need of the future. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Now for the last formal presentation, it's by James E. Foy, Editorial Director, KNBC-TV.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I see all the smart money just got up and left. That's always very encouraging. Actually, you know, I took this gig on the understanding that I'd be first, and here I am last, and I don't know how to edit all this stuff, but they... Actually, I wrote several versions of what I was going to say, and Bill and Larry and Tom showed up without any notes, so I gave them mine. How's that? Now you've heard of it. When Bob Hall and I got here early, we walked into the room, it was empty, and I made a smart crack, you know, gee, the attendance was a little light. It's still a little light, and maybe that's part of the problem, that the experts, and you are the experts, are not adequately aware, perhaps, of the meaning of the whole credibility gap. And I'm not going to take an awful long time, but I do want to take a few minutes to dance through some of the things, 4 points that I'm going to try to make. I think there's a strange public perception of what facts are. I want to tell you a little bit about the media's role in giving them those facts, at least some of those facts. I want to talk very briefly about your role as experts in the technology of things, and I also want to touch quickly on the role of management. Now, that, you know, this is a seminar. That's a 3-day thing, but I'm going to try to do it rather quickly as I can. Incidentally, for those of you who don't live in Los Angeles, you'll be pleased to learn that I'm usually primed to speak in time periods of like 2 minutes. That's all they give me for editorial. I can't guarantee that I'll do it that well, but I'll try to do it quickly. You know, I think it was Mark Twain or Will Rogers or one of those homespun philosophers who said that all the trouble in the world isn't made by people who are stupid. All the trouble is made by people who know a lot of stuff that ain't so. And that's, you know, you have to kind of write that on your desk somewhere. And here's another one. The truth, whatever it is of no importance in guiding people's actions. What is important is what they think is true. So again, the facts may not be important. It's what people think are facts. For example, in the whole question of power need, the distortion is that new power needs for tomorrow or for today, for developing countries or for new levels of consumption, are to run toothbrushes, electric toothbrushes. You and I know that isn't so, but that's the kind of thought that's somehow permeating the public consciousness. Incidentally, the power industry isn't alone. You know, you've got the automobile industry with you. You've got every other industry, maybe all of American business with you. Let me give you a couple of things that I picked up over the last couple of months from the public prints and here and there. Here's a letter from the letter to the editor of the Burbank Daily Review not too long ago. He goes on at some length. He wasn't responding to anything that I could figure out. He was just venting his spleen about electric power and specifically nuclear power. And he says, "The heat created is tremendous and must be rigidly controlled within the plant. Likewise, the radioactive gases must be contained. Naturally, there must be a backup control system, too, designed to take over if the primary controls fail for any reason. Unfortunately, the backup system used in all nuclear power plants, never has been tested in service, and 6 times out of 6 has failed in laboratory tests. And it's right here in type. It's, and people believe what they read, don't they? I don't care what they say about 69% of the people believing television. How can I be twice as credible as you are? You know, I got the information from you. But people do believe what they read, and here it is, right there in black and white. Here's another thing from a PTA newsletter sent around. There are serious dangers involved in producing nuclear energy, and even the Nuclear Energy Commission, I didn't know we had one by that name, has stated fission is not the answer. A few of the reasons are, and they go on, into, she goes on to the heat here, millions of fish and other aquatic life have already been destroyed by being pulled into the cooling system of the atomic plants already in action. Millions of fish. Another point she makes are that the waste produced are radioactive and will remain so for at least 100 years. Yes. And then she goes on through some other detail about options, power options. Another more desirable method involves burning hydrogen gas. Hydrogen is easily made in the laboratory from seawater. The only major waste is water vapor, which in a short time returns to seawater and again becomes the source for more hydrogen. If you want the name of this lady so you can get a touch, I think she's got something there. And from a perhaps a more responsible group, here's the Sierra Club National News Report early last month, reporting something that's said by a guy named Denenbert. I always thought it was Denenberg, the Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner of Pennsylvania. And he's quoted as saying, "It is morally repugnant for the public's lives and property to be gambled on a massive nuclear fission adventure while the corporate assets of the nuclear industry are so carefully protected from liability claims." They're talking, of course, about the Price-Anderson Act. And that brings us to a second part of things. And this is the role of the media and how the media are used and who the media listen to. And what kinds of things tend to make news. Incidentally, despite having picked these things up, I am totally convinced that the great majority of people still think, for example, that nuclear power is safe. They acknowledge some risks, but they feel that that is the only way to go in the long term. I hope that I stay right. I think the trend is away from that, and I think that's sort of worrisome. Let me talk briefly about the role of the media. You got to remember that news is death and destruction. News isn't the story of all the cats in the world. News is the story of the cats that climbed up the telephone pole. You're not going to get any ink or any TV attention, certainly, by an erudite, thorough discussion of the economics of power plant construction, projections for the future, or load. They'll fall asleep right in the middle of the whole thing. It really doesn't matter so much what you say, especially on television, if you've said it for more than about 2 minutes, because they're all out walking the dog anyway. You've got to somehow translate all of the difficult, complex, worrisome information you've got, and you've got to digest it and make it meaningful. That Denenberg quote, for example, widely quoted, but you know, as I say, the power industry is not alone. Ralph Nader has hardly touched you so far. Nicholas Johnson made big headlines some years ago with TV as a wasteland. You remember that? I'm sure that's stuck in your consciousness. He said we were molesting the minds of the nation's children. That stuck with people. The defense. Does anybody here remember it? Does anybody here remember the thorough statements, well-reasoned, well-written, produced by the network presidents? I don't remember them myself. I don't think we had any. Does anybody remember the response to the charge of obscene profits for the petroleum companies? Anybody here? There might as well not have been one. You've got to remember that ink, attention by the media, tends to go to those who challenge existing perceptions. You've got to challenge the perceptions. That's the key to the whole thing of getting people's attentions and certainly of getting the media attention. There's a couple of other things. A point raised initially by Frank, and nobody has addressed it. It concerns guys like Dr. John Goffman and Tamplin and others who are challenging existing perceptions within your specialty and specifically within the nuclear side of things. They get all the ink. They wind up with the ear of the media. The defenders don't. I do think that there is a responsibility on the part of the industry, and not just the utility companies, but everyone else in the industry, to respond quickly with facts and with some strength. You know, the automatic kind of response is that when one of these molesting the minds or obscene profits charges comes out, that day the newsmen go looking around for somebody to present the other side, and nobody's there because they're all in there huddling with their lawyers, talking it all over, seeing what. Takes them 4 days to get the strategy figured out, and by that time, somebody's on to pillory some other kind of industry. As far as the people are concerned, that must be true. Nobody responded. Nobody said anything. That must be right. Use editorial replies. Take advantage of the opportunity that you have immediately to respond. Sue. There's nothing quite so good as taking somebody into court and calling them a liar. Beautiful. It's great. And somebody ought to do it oftener, every day. That is the role of the expert. And I really feel that you're overlooking it. A couple of other things, and I'll try to dance through them quickly. I know, you know, it's getting late and it's been a long day for you. Engineers rarely have done much debating. You know, it's just not one of the things that you get to. Start learning it. Learning the techniques of debate. Learn to insult people, obviously, into their face. It may not be the sort of thing you'll use often, but sometime or another you're going to need it. Do like lawyers do. Have mock trials. As you discuss what kinds of things you're going to have to talk about concerning rates or concerning the safety of your plants, challenge one another. There's nothing worse than sending some rather unsuspecting engineer to talk about his specialty to an auditorium filled with people who know a great deal more about it than he ever thought they did. And they just attack him and destroy him. I think the oil industry learned that the hard way with the congressional hearings on the energy crisis. And you got to remember what the politicians do, incidentally, as you're talking about techniques of argument. Never get mad. Get even. Try to hit your pitch. Try to make sure that the argument gets brought around to the areas in which you're comfortable. Don't get strung out in somebody else's ball yard. Don't go for the low outside one. Make sure that it's something you're familiar with. Try to avoid making engineers talk about price structures. Engineers as a group tend not to have worried much about price structures, and try to avoid having the lawyers and the PR men talk about emergency core cooling systems. Those are the kinds of things that wind up getting awfully important. Translate, summarize, attack, if there are any one-word kinds of messages I'd like to leave with you. Now, for the management role, set the strategy, but do it quickly. Stay in policy areas and let the technicians and the experts worry about the technical areas. Clarify some of the alternatives. Open up, as everybody here has said, open up and let the people in a little bit on the same kinds of worries that you go through in making sure that you've chosen the right alternatives for them. And let them know. And not just open up to your own people. How many of you people in this auditorium tonight have ever gone into a junior high school, for example, civics class, to talk about electric power and the economics of power and power consumption? I'll bet there aren't half a dozen. Could I see some hands? Dozen, 15, maybe 20. That's not enough. That's just not enough. It ought to be twice that many. And you're cheating too. I'll bet you're talking about. I'll bet you're talking about senior high schools, and that doesn't count. By then, their minds are made up. Anyway, one last thing. Remember, in this entire arena, you're dealing with some political realities, and you're going to need some strong political support. What happens when guys like Craig Hosmer, Chet Holifield, retire, not just for Southern California, for the country? What happens to the guys who have kind of propped up the entire nuclear power industry? I don't know. I don't really know who the people are who move into those positions of some prominence within those congressional committees. But it may be somebody who just has a totally different orientation than you may find comfortable. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. I'm sure there are some questions that the five panel members have that they would like to direct or to each other or to make a point about. So at this time, we will open up and give them the opportunity for an interchange. Where would we like to begin? All right?
Well, I'm known for my subtlety and diplomacy, so possibly I can ease us into it. I'd like to comment, make a statement, and possibly ask a question of Tom Harris. I think the problem we've been discussing tonight devolved to a great extent on growth. And the implication here is that we must control growth. And I think I would make the statement that, diplomatically, that Tom said that pricing has got to change now, the implication being to change growth by charging more for more use. My comment would be, I think you're out of your cotton-picking mind, because I think this denigrates the ability of the people, you, me, everybody else, to choose what I would choose for me and my country when confronted with the total costs. Now, it's true, we have not internalized external costs of the environmental damage, but this has been our mistake in this country. This is not a culpability. This is a mere fact of life. If we are to do this kind of social engineering, then my question comes, who is prescient enough to be able to do this? Who decides that we penalize someone for high use? Or who decides, conversely, maybe we should go and say that nobody here can use any more than he's using now? I would hate to be the one to go to the people in Spanish Harlem and tell them that next year they can't have air conditioning, they've had enough. And I'd be interested in Tom's comments on that.
Already having a credibility gap speaking from somebody who's out of his mind, I may have some problem answering the question. I knew we were going to get to this because we got warmed up pretty good before we got here. But it's just as well, because this is where we really have to bite the bullet in any case. I don't know why you're so upset with the suggestion of rate change. I don't know what that has to do with social engineering. I don't think it has a thing to do with it. I think it's just a proper cost analysis system. Is that you're charging people for the true cost of the product. It's got nothing to do with social engineering at all, which is not to say that it doesn't have social impact. Everything that we do has social impact. And I don't know who has to, I guess that's why we elect governments, is to try and figure out how, once we have a system, we don't deny, put somebody in Harlem sweltering in 90-degree heat through the day while we're sitting here with, what the hell, 40% more light than we need in this building? And this is pretty good. Most of them are 150 to 200%. I really can't get upset about that too much because we've got it so bad now, which is not to say we have to leave it that way, but I don't think that's the electric utility's role to play. I have never suggested that it was, that they have to come up with the answer for the social discrepancies and inequities that exist in our system. And I think it would be beyond them in any case. But I do believe that they have to properly cost out and charge for the true cost of their product. And I don't think that bulk rate block charging does that by any matter of means. It encourages all the wrong uses. And if we all have to, if the customer's the guy who has to pay for it in the end anyway, what's the difference? If he's going to have to pay for it, at least let him have his way, that he's going to have it so that we don't get into this situation where you just encourage more and more big-time use. And if he's going to have to get into this role of when he does conserve and turn down his thermostat, Then the next month he watches you go to PUC and get a 5 or 10% rate increase. Okay, if that makes him angry, so it makes him angry. But that's the way it's going to have to be, and he's got to realize that too. But at least if we get a more equitable arrangement in cost so that you're paying the true unit cost of the product, then at least he's going to say, well, I know the other guy down the street's angry too, so that maybe that's not too bad. I don't know whether that answers your question, but I did want to clarify that I don't think price change is social engineering. I don't think social engineering is the role of the utility companies. I don't believe they're up to it, and I'm not sure who else is.
All right, Larry?
I hesitate to disagree with a colleague, but I do believe that utilities should develop a social conscience. I believe that there is a relationship between rate structure and social engineering. And I think perhaps the most obvious example, and it was dramatically brought home to me, when I did a story once very recently on rate increases and how they are coming faster and faster and higher. And I got a bundle of mail, and I got an endless string of phone calls, and almost 90% of them were from people who were elderly and on fixed income Social Security. And they were all calling up and writing to say, who do we turn to organize? Because we want to go to the PUC and we want to make our feelings known to Edison and the DWP that we can't pay one more dime for electricity. And some of the letters I got were genuine and they were pathetic. And these are people who are eating pet food, who can no longer afford to even turn on their television set. And I think that this is an example of a population that deserves attention by the utility companies, and I think that if a large segment of our population continues to suffer as rates escalate, and if they are not given some sort of help, and if the utilities don't take a lead in this, I think that the companies are making a drastic error, and this is just one example where I think the companies can step out and do something positive and work constructively with the Public Utilities Commission to come up with an answer to a very severe social problem.
All right, Ed?
This conversation reminds me a good deal of the bumper sticker that says, the next time you need a cop, call a hippie. We, of course, do base our rates on cost. And certainly that energy-related portion of our cost that is affected by the increased cost of low-sulfur fuel oil has had a dramatic impact on levelizing the rate and is a demonstration of the validity of the concept of cost pricing. I would remind those people who feel that we should go to less than cost that in the food business, the government gives food stamps. And if the government wishes to pass on their welfare in utility services such as telephones or gas or electricity, that is the preferred route. We basically have three obligations or three allocations of costs in rate making. We have seen the impact of the energy component when in our case in the last 18 months, what was once a 2.7 cent per kilowatt hour average residential rate has gone up for fuel costs alone across the board to all classes of customers 1 full cent. And maybe the pricing that the oil companies or the sheiks or the gas companies who sell us fuel do not include is the internalized external costs of depreciation, resource depletion. I'll grant you that. However, we also have about a $4 billion investment in thing called plant, which are generating stations, transmission lines, and distribution systems dedicated and used and useful in the service of the public. And the allocation of these plants and the need for these plants vary from class of customer to class of customer. And we have a third component, which is called the customer cost and this of service, and this definitely varies from customer to customer. The minute you depart from a cost price relationship, then you have departed from the fundamental concept of the free enterprise system, we are not about to voluntarily depart from that in any social engineering adventure.
We may be departing a little bit from the credibility question here, but perhaps in arriving at some answers that we get, we'll get some understanding just as along with it. All right, Jim, you have...
I just want to take an opportunity to disagree with a colleague. Larry, I don't mind that.
Whew, I thought I was going to get it again.
I suppose in the news media, I'm supposed to be... I'm supposed to have some other economic orientation.